We all have a story to tell. Let's tell yours. Welcome to the Intellectual People Podcast with your host, Jason. Come together and listen to journey stories and more from interesting people. Welcome your host, Jason.
Welcome to the Intellectual People Podcast. I often post on forums, and I'd like to personally thank those forum owners for allowing me to post on those forums. In no particular order, they are audioscienceReview.com, audiocircle.com, audioshark.org, audiophilestyle.com, AV Nirvana, which is also the home of Room EQ Wizard and Audio Lens, DIYAudio.com, Gears.com, and Parts Express Forum. Thank you so much and enjoy. Today on the Intellectual People Podcast, I have Todd Welty of Harman. How are you doing today, Todd?
I'm slightly better than average.
That's the right step in the right direction.
Yeah, right.
So, Todd, first tell us what Harman is.
Wow, what Harman is. Well, it's a huge company, as you know, that is involved in many, many different facets of audio and even beyond audio. It's since I started 20 years ago, it's gone off in a lot of different directions. You know, we're getting into machine learning and all different kinds of different, you know, offshoots and automotive, a lot of, you know, intelligent automotive, you know, devices and technologies. And so it's really large, but it was, I guess, you know, what makes it different, if I may say, is that it was really founded on really solid ideas about audio and about how we, you know, how we hear things and how we design products and stuff, and especially listening tests. You know, gathering subjective data is something that really sets Harman apart. There's not too many other companies that do it, as it's expensive. It takes a lot of effort, and you know, sometimes people do it and then they don't know what to do with the data. You have to know what you're doing, but it's really worthwhile, and that's one thing that Harman, you know, that you'll find, and that's gotten us a lot of traction, I think, in the community and the audio community, is that we do this. We're not the only one, but it's just not typical. Most companies maybe can't afford it or just don't know how. So that's one thing that makes us different. You know, of course, we were bought by Samsung a few years ago. So we're now part of Samsung, but from what my experience has not really changed. We still operate a lot the same. We're getting into more immersive technology. That's a big push in the last couple of years. So you're going to see more and more immersive technologies being you know, pushed to the limit by Harman. So
what is your position at Harman?
I am a distinguished engineer at currently. So I worked my way up from, I think when I started, I was a research acoustician. They didn't know. I asked them what's my position, and Floyd, you know, Floyd Toole, who was my originally hired me, he said, I don't know, research acoustician. That's what we'll call you. So that's where I was for a long time, and then I worked my way up, and now I as of last year, I'm distinguished engineer. So it's near the top of where you can get and still be in the engineering track. You know, like I mentioned before, I'm interested in the science and not so much the management area. So I'm trying to go as far as I can in the engineering and science track, and that's where I am. Yeah.
Were you always into the science of acoustics?
Yeah. Well, I was always into science ever since I was a little kid.
Okay.
When I was a really little kid, I would take some wire and I would ball up one end of it and stick it in my ear and try to make a radio or stuff. I mean, that's how I got my humble beginnings.
Yeah.
Lucky I didn't, you know, poke my eardrum out or something, but I was always interested in science. Not so much necessarily audio. I mean, I was interested in lots of different, you know, physics or whatever. I my interest was way outstripping my, you know, ability to, you know, I mean, I'm not any kind of genius, but I always had the curiosity and the interest in it. And then how I got into audio was literally, I had just gotten my degree in electrical engineering and I was just looking for a job. And I went to this headhunter and he goes, well, I know this guy, he's an acoustical consultant and he's looking for somebody. And I said, yeah, that sounds cool. I mean, a lot of, you know, there's many same principles that are involved in both. And I said, yeah, that sounds interesting. And I went and he liked me. And so I started as a consultant, and I did that for 9 years. And it was a great introduction. I mean, I got to do all different kinds of things, from crawling around in buildings, measuring, you know, chillers, you know, in the bowels of a high-rise building somewhere. And then the next day I'd be out measuring dogs barking at a kennel or something. I mean, it was just, it was all over the place. And I had a great mentor, Michael Yantis, by the way, and shout out to you. And he really, you know, taught me so much, and it was a great introduction. So that's kind of how I got started in audio.
And how did you wind up at Harman?
So I, after 9 years, I thought, you know what, I really want to go back and get some more school. And so I went back and I went to Denmark to get my master's over there. And they had a really nice program. They have still a really nice program, heavily centered on binaural acoustics, which was interesting to me. So I went over there. They were very friendly, you know, great people. And, you know, everything was in English, which is good, because I never got very far with my Danish. So so I was over there for a couple of years and then got my master's. And then during that time, and even before, when I was a consultant, I had seen papers by Floyd Toole and Sean Olive. I even used a couple of them in my master's thesis. And then when I got out, I was, you know, I was looking around and I see an ad in the AES for they're looking for somebody. And I said, I know those guys. You know, they're serious guys. I mean, they know what they're doing. So I applied, and I guess the timing was good and they liked me, and so I got hired. So it was, you know, my professional career has been, I guess, blessed in many ways by, I just got lucky twice in a row. And that's that my entire, you know, career is basically two jobs. Wow. And great ones. Yeah.
And you've made Harman truly a home, right? I mean, been there a long time.
Yes. Yes. 20 years. I've seen a lot of people come and go. It's a little bit smaller now than it was. You know, there's some people were lost, but then new people came in, and so there's always things going on. So, but yeah, they've made me feel pretty comfortable.
Can you explain to us what your daily job, what you're actually responsible for?
Yeah. Well, I mean, 20 years is a long time to cover. So, you know, some of the highlights have been, you know, I mentioned subjective tests. That's a real sort of hallmark of Harman. And I've been involved in, you know, our department has been involved in those. That's kind of, we were pretty much responsible for that. And there's been some other groups that sprung up and doing it as well. But we did a lot of the early subjective testing on loudspeakers. So, you know, the idea was to do some really good quality objective tests of loudspeakers and chambers and whatnot, and then do some really good subjective tests to get some very high quality subjective data of what people prefer. And then, you know, how do we connect those? How do we predict preference from the measurements? And that was obviously a big project, and it was started on speakers, and then we did a little bit in automotive, and then we went to headphones. So that was the, up till about 2 years ago, I was heavily involved in that for about five, six years. Lately, I've been getting into some more immersive stuff, with, you know, room acoustics, speaker room interactions, and even involving some machine learning and stuff. And so it's research, you know, it's a lot of it research. And then lately, it's been getting more, a little bit more oriented towards product development, which is fun. You know, it's very interesting to see, you know, to be involved at a lower level of detail in actually producing actual products. But I'd say it's still mostly research, though. I spend a lot of time doing like modeling rooms, for example, or writing MATLAB code. That probably accounts for a big chunk of my time, writing code to generate files and calculate things and model things. And yeah.
When you say model a room, can you explain to us what you're actually doing and what you're looking for?
Yeah. Well, so what I'm lately, what I've been working on is in COMSOL. So COMSOL is a very sophisticated program that can model, you know, any shape of room. In my original subwoofer work, it was all rectangular rooms. And that was okay, because, you know, a large proportion of rooms are rectangular. And so we could focus on that, but I never really had any tools to to get into, you know, non-rectangular, you know, L-shaped or whatever rooms. And right. lately I've been able to do that because now we have a console license, so I can model it. So I'm in the still in the very steep part of the console learning curve, which okay. it's really incredible. I mean, it's by far the most sophisticated piece of software I've ever used. And
really?
Yeah. So it can do incredible, amazing things. Room acoustics. Well, room acoustics is one thing, and that in itself is a huge thing, but you can model, you know, mechanics, you can model electromagnetics, you can model any kind of physics, it seems like, and you can then model systems that have more than one of these components and how they interact. And it would take me, you know, 20 more years probably to even get an inkling of how that works. So yeah, modeling rooms and I'm still kind of focusing on the low frequency stuff.
Okay.
So which is that's just cool. Room mode, standing waves, that kind of stuff. But I'm just able to get into more complex rooms now with console. So.
And when you say modeling for the low frequency stuff, you're speaking specifically about modeling for multiple subwoofers, correct?
Yeah.
Is that still, or even like full range monitors in a room, how that is affected by a room as well, or?
No, it's still focusing on the low frequencies.
Okay.
Which is, there's still plenty of traction to be had in that area. Cause right. you know, the big problem that I've been working on with subwoofers in rooms is the seat to seat difference, which you get, which you know about standing waves and all that. And it's
right.
It's definitely the 500 pound gorilla in the room, and it's you know, we have some better tools now than we used to, but it still crops up, you know, regularly, and people are, you know, I still get emails every few days from people in forums that have read my paper way back in 2003 or whatever and still having questions about it. So it's still pertinent.
And I will mention, I will put the links below for that paper. For the multiple subwoofers that Todd has written, so everybody can really read it and study it, because there's a lot of information there.
Yeah, we have some white paper. I don't know which link you were thinking, but we have a white paper version on the Harman site.
Okay.
If you can't find it, let me know. I'll send you a link. That's a good place because it's free, yep. and it's there's some PowerPoint presentation in there, or two that is maybe a little easier to digest than an AES paper. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to think was yeah. the AES paper.
Okay, that's good too, but...
I'll put them all below. How's that?
Okay. That'll work.
Okay, yeah. So let's get into it. So what I'm curious to know is, I'm sure you're well aware of who Earl Geddes is.
Correct? Oh, yes. I know Earl. Yeah.
Were you guys both working on multiple subwoofer research at the same time, since you actually wrote the paper and were quote unquote, you know, first to the market, if you will, he was left behind in that regard. And I'm curious to know, timing wise, was it something that you were working on in parallel coincidentally at the same time as him, and you just actually put it on paper, or was it something that really started for you much earlier than that?
It didn't start. I think the first paper came out within a year of when I started on it. So that was, you know, pretty much when I started. I think maybe Earl might have been working before that. I get the feeling he was. And I think maybe he, you know, he has his own method, which is a little bit different, and it relies a little bit more on trial and error. So it has some differences. And I'm guessing he would say that he was working on that well before, but it was just kind of formulating. He was experimenting around to see what worked. And then I don't know, I don't really think it officially, you know, was published in a paper. He just kind of started right. talking about it, and people picked it up and stuff. So, yeah.
Understood. What about your method do you believe is superior? And I'm not trying to make this a Geddes versus Welty argument at all. And I want everybody to know that, because that's not the case. I would much rather somebody pick a method and do it than not do it at all, because either method will certainly improve the main issues of the problem. Correct? Would you agree with that?
Sure. I think either one would be helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
But obviously with you here, I want to talk about the Welty method, because that's really what you're here for.
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely some differences. One of them is that mine is focused only on rectangular rooms, and I think that Earl's would be maybe applicable in more complex shapes, which is actually, you know, that's benefit of his method. On the other hand, his method is involving trial and error, which of course is more work, but you know, it gives you a better result, I think. So, I mean, you could use my method and then add trial and error on top of that as well and get an improved result. So, his method is using three subs, if I recall, which I never, when I did my, in rectangular rooms, I tried like 1, 2, 3, and I tried all possible positions, and I kept coming up with that 2 and 4 seem to work better. So I don't know, I'm not sure if 3, you know, I'm sure he has reasons for it, but what I've seen, it seemed like 2 or 4 seem to work better. So there's that. And I think basically that I'm using, I think, what seems to be a better number of subs for my method. I mean, again, maybe when, you know, he has 2 and then he does the trial and error on the 3rd one. And maybe I guess the other thing too is that mine has been scientifically investigated and published. I mean, I've done experiments that are, you can read up on it exactly what I did. I tested it in real rooms and I got basically the same result and all that. And his is more of a home recipe sort of, I mean, not, I don't mean that in a bad way, but I don't think there's a paper on it where he's done tests in a set number of rooms and stuff that shows that it's better. So, you know, I'm sure it is, but
And it should go, it's worth mentioning, in my opinion, that you're very fortunate in terms of the resource that you have behind you, right? The resource of Armin is massive.
Yes.
And so knowing what to do and having the money behind that is extremely beneficial than truly a one-man band doing it all on his own time and effort and cost, right? And I think that's worth mentioning.
That's true. And I mean, this was basically, it was my job for a couple of years. He, on the other hand, is a consultant. He has other work, so he probably didn't have as much time maybe. That absolutely, yeah.
Okay. So let's get into the Welty method. For the people that have never read about it and know nothing about it, and also for the people that are familiar with it, but it's a little confusing. And I think it's really important to point out that multiple subwoofers, the concept is fairly simple, but the execution of it is somewhat difficult for especially somebody that's never done it before. And I go back to someone like myself. It was really difficult the first time, and it gets easier if you do it constantly. But the reality is you typically do it once, you set it up, and that's pretty much it. If you're not a tinkerer, constant changing of equipment, you pretty much, and then when you have to do it again, it's really tough because it's like you remember it, but you forgot most of it, right?
Yeah, right.
So if you can, just walk us through the basics, if you don't mind. And let's get into the meat of how to set it up.
Okay. Well, just to clarify, there's two kind of general methods that I worked on. One of them, the first one was, you know, all rectangular rooms, and it's simply where's the best positions to put your subs. That's what most people, by a factor of, I don't know, 6 or 8, most people seem to glom onto that because, it's simpler. And, so in that method, it's really setting it up isn't too hard because it's the fundamental thing is that your subwoofers are identical, right? If you're going to use one of these preferred positions, it's predicated on that your subwoofers are identical. So in a way that kind of simplifies it, right? Because, you know, you don't have, like, I get questions all the time. Should I put 2 10s in the front and 12s in the back or whatever? In that, you know, basic method, they're all the same. They all have the same signal. You may you don't change the gain or anything. They're all exactly the same. So you put them in the positions, you measure it, and hopefully, you know, you get, you know, on average, you get a better result. I should also add, you may not always get a better result. It's kind of a increase your odds of getting a better result sort of thing. So that's why some people I've heard some people on forums or whatever say, I tried, it didn't work good for me. And I'm thinking, well, I kind of expected that there would be a percentage where that didn't work for them. So and the other basic, well, actually not so basic technique is what we call sound field management, which is something that came after. And that's one where you take, it's can apply to any room, it can apply to any number of subwoofers. They could even be different, and you basically make a lot of measurements, and then you feed it all into a computer, and it basically tries a bunch of things and comes up with a solution, and then you implement it. Now that one is more complicated because you have to know how to make measurements. Oh, my phone is ringing. It's going nuts. Can you hear that?
I can.
Okay, good. So that method is more complicated, and I'm guessing most of your audience is more interested in the first one anyway. Those are the two methods. What was your original question? I got off on a tangent there.
Basically explaining how they would go about setting it up. And I want to ask one question about your second method. Is that something for, right? There's a big range of listeners, and everybody's resource is different. So if somebody wanted to go about that second method, how is that something that they could acquire or pay someone to do? How is that possible?
Yes. I guess right now if you're going to use that particular method, it's available to Synthesis installers. So okay. It hasn't really been made available as a product you can buy. There was a product, I don't know, 10 years ago called BaseQ, JBL BaseQ, I think it was, actually had a slightly different but very similar method in it. That's been discontinued for some years. And then there are some methods online, base optimization. There's a software that you'll find links to it at AVR or at, I've seen links to it. I forgot where, but it's called Subwoofer Base Optimization or something like that.
Okay.
And that's basically a very similar thing. So there's at least one that you could download and use, I guess. But still, you need to make these measurements. And if the measurements are not correct, your results will not be correct. So,
and the JBL Synthesis dealers, is this is a service that they offer? If somebody just wanted to incorporate multiple subwoofers, somebody could find their local JBL Synthesis installer and they would come out and do that?
That's a good question. Whether if it wasn't like a full install, I don't know whether right. They would come out just for that. I'm sure if you offered them enough, they would.
Yep.
But it's normally part of a package, of a Synthesis, home theater install package.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do they? And when you say similar subs or the same sub, you're just saying a subwoofer, not necessarily. They don't all four don't have to be all 10 inch or 15 inch or 18 inch or whatever the flavor is, correct?
Are we talking about sound field management still, or the vanilla flavor?
Vanilla flavor.
Vanilla flavor. They should really be identical. They should be. I mean, yeah, because if one of them, if the cutoff frequency is a little different, then the phase is not adding up right, then. I don't know. it's assuming they're all identical.
And does that change if you have? And I don't want to reference back to Earl. However, in my past, I have used. They were two different styles, and it wasn't an issue as far as I know. I'm just curious to know if using different styles is truly an issue, because if you're going to measure, why would that be an issue?
Well, if you're talking about the vanilla flavor one, that's the one where you just place the subs at the optimal locations. But if you're talking about the one where you measure, that's SFM, then in that case, you could use different subs. Maybe I wasn't clear. Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
I was just thinking now for the vanilla flavor one, I haven't really thought about this, but if you had, let's say you had, two 10s and two 12s and you wanted to just pick the optimal location, you could, for example, do like a near field measurement and sort of force them to be as similar as possible and then consider them to be close enough and then use them. That could be possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you say vanilla setup system, you're literally meaning taking subwoofers that are identical, plopping them down in the ideal position in that room, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Not really measuring and tuning them to the room.
Well, I mean, first of all, you could, it would probably be a great idea to also do some trial and error on top of that and see if you can get it even better, of course. And then, of course, your crossover and all that, how are you going to do that? You will need to measure at some point. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. And your position locations are very well mapped out. Correct me if I'm wrong. In terms of room shape and size, you have some very precise locations on the ideal locations for those subwoofers, correct?
I mean, they're fairly precise. I'm assuming that they're precise. I haven't really done a study to see, you know, if they were off a few inches, you know, what would the effect be? I will mention that there's a compendium on the Harman website, which was, you know, after I did the original research, I went back and I did another, you know, a little bit more sophisticated look at it. And I looked at, you know, different, you know, which different subwoofer setups work well with which sized rooms. So it's taking it a little bit further. Let's make this more specific. Let's give the user a tool so that if they have a, you know, 6 by 8 meter room, so they know what the dimensions are, then which of these, of say 6 different subwoofer configurations would be best in that room? Or let's say they have 4 subs and they want to use, you know, configuration, the 4 corners, for example, what's a good dimension for the rooms that would go with that configuration? And on top of that, even the audience position is also a factor. What if we have a small audience that's in the center, or what if we have a small audience or a large audience in the back third? You know, those are two different, you know, it can give you two different results. So I have made this library where they can look up, you know, with some granularity, of course, but they can look up to find the situation that's closest to their room and get, you know, even a better recommendation for the sub placement.
Did you find a pattern with that? Was it somewhat linear with room size?
No, it was not. I found some of the plots where there are two different metrics. One is the seat to seat variance, which is the most important one, but there's also a base efficiency metric because we don't want to throw away all of our base, or some people are concerned. They don't want to throw away all their base to get this consistent. So we look at both of those. And then on some of them, you would see one of those metrics getting better up to a certain size room and then maybe getting worse after. And I'll tell you something else very interesting that came out of that was this this discussion. I'm sure you've heard you should never have square rooms.
Yep.
I mean, tell me a person who has looked at subwoofers who hasn't heard, you know, the old adage, you know, you should never have square rooms. Well, I actually looked at that. And what I found was that if you put a sub in the corner, like one sub in the corner, like most people do, then it's absolutely true. Square room will give you the worst seat to seat variance, you know, or it's bad or the worst.
Right.
But if you use an optimized subwoofer layout, then square room is just fine. It's not a problem. And that was a bit surprising at first. Very interesting that you know, some of these adages that are generated for they're very generalized and they don't, you know, they don't apply in every situation. So
right.
I found that very interesting and useful little thing to know.
And what would you say the optimal setup is then for a square room?
Oh, for square room? Well, I have to look it up. that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. Good question.
Okay.
I'll look it up after we're done.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, that's linked in the link that you'll hopefully send me so I can point people directly to the Harman link on that. Okay, great.
Yes. Yep.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Are you able to model a room and know if the height of a subwoofer is affected? Is that legitimate?
If it's affected, or you mean if it has an effect?
Yeah, if it has an effect. I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah, I have done some of that, and it does. It's, you know, in the rooms that I was modeling, the effect was not really below maybe 50 or 55 hertz, because, you know, the ceiling, unless you have a taller ceiling, but with typical ceilings, you wouldn't see much effect below 50 or 55. And then above that, yeah, you would start to see some effect.
And when we say typical, you mean 9 to 10 feet ceiling height?
2.7 meters, but about 9 feet. Yeah.
You work in the meter world, huh?
But for writing AES papers, we're encouraged to use metric.
Understood.
Yeah.
That makes sense. If you say that below 50 hertz, it doesn't have much of an effect, how high of an effect does it have on the other side in terms of mid-bass?
I mean, I would say below 50 hertz, it has virtually no effect. Above, you know, from 50 to 60 or 70, it has a small effect. And above that, you know, it can be considerable, I guess, just going from memory. But yeah, so that's one thing that's come up before is you know, that like Earl has incorporated that into his third subwoofer. I think he's encourages people to move it up and down. And in my original work, we just kind of assumed as a simplifying assumption that everything was on the floor. And I remember him asking me about that and pointing that out to me. And it's true. It's kind of a simplifying thing. And if I had more time, I would love to go back and look at that again.
Is it something that you recommend people play with? If they're able to get their subwoofer 2 feet off the ground and get it mid-wall maybe, is that something that you would recommend?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, why not? Especially like, you know, if you know, in-wall subwoofers are becoming more of a thing, even in ceiling or whatever. So that should, I guess that comes up, you know, more than it did back, you know, when I was doing it. But yeah, I mean,
okay,
why not?
You're not opposed to it?
No,
okay, not at all. Okay, and you can certainly model it and see a correlation there.
I mean, you can see a difference. I guess one thing I would say is if you're going to use any of the you know, configurations that I've identified, they all assume that the subwoofer is near the floor. So if you move one of them up or something, I mean, you're not gonna, you know, maybe it improves it, but yeah, I don't know. You're all bets are off, I guess, if you start moving them vertically. But if you want to try it and see if it works, and then move it back down if it doesn't help or whatever, it's
okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Hopefully, Harman will invest some money so you can do some more research on that topic.
Yeah. I'd love to.
Do you find that, and I don't know if you have experience with the end user because of your mainly research, but do you find even with the JBL synthesis side that it's a very misunderstood concept of multiple subwoofers?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some misunderstanding. One of the biggest ones that comes up all the time for me is that I'll have somebody come up and start asking me questions, and you know, about multiple subwoofers, and then after 10 minutes, I come to find out they only have one seat. it's a money seat, and that's all there is. And I kind of throw my hands up and say, well, forget everything I just said, because it's all based on multiple seats. That's the fundamental assumption, is that you have multiple, at least two, or you know, three or four or five, whatever seats in an area, and that you're trying to make, you know, the bass more consistent there. If you only have one seat, then there's not, you know, there's minimal advantage, I guess, to using multiple subs. You know, you might as well just stack them on top of each other and get some boundary loading advantage or something, right? I mean, so that's one misunderstanding. That
why is that? Why would, whether you're trying to get three seats to sound similar or only the sweet spot, if you will, to sound optimal, why would that change whether four subs or no subs would be used?
Well, I guess the you know, and maybe this will probably cause a wailing and a gnashing of teeth in the audio community, but you know, if you had two subwoofers, let's say you have two subwoofers and you basically have one seat that you care about, I would say stick it in the corner, stack it with the subs together or however, and then equalize it for your one seat. Because, you know, the thing that multiple subwoofers helps to solve is to get control over multiple responses at different locations. If you have only one sub, then you have only one channel to modify, and if you think about it, you'll see that all you can do is you know, you can't really do anything to affect seat to seat variance with just one subwoofer. And if you only have one seat, then you know, why would you have, what would it be the advantage of two subwoofers at two different locations? I guess I would bounce that question back to you and say, what?
Yeah, and it's shocking to me because I'm a one seat room. And yet multiple subwoofers to me is the only way, because it really does flatten the response down, right?
Yeah.
And it makes, it makes that one seat optimal, and the room response becomes so flat that why would you not want it, is what my question would be.
Well, I don't know that you know, in my experience using multiple subwoofers, it doesn't necessarily make it flat. I mean,
well, it flattens maybe out room nodes, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, but using, I think maybe you're referring to that 5,000 subwoofer thing in my original paper. I did this impossible to do in real life experiment where I modeled a room with 5,000 subwoofers in it, and indeed, it kind of did cancel out the mode. So I guess yeah, in some very general sense, you know, having more subwoofers, you know, does. But from going from one to two, I don't know whether it would have that much effect. In some of the experiments that I did, we added multiple subs. It made the seats more consistent, but it may have made the response less flat. So, maybe in your room, maybe it does.
I suppose I should clarify. When I say multiple subs, I apologize. I think to the average listener, multiple subs would be more than one, right? I'm talking three to four.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So in my room with four subwoofers, two flanking up front, two flanking subwoofers, and then one in a rear corner, and then what I would call my mid-bass subwoofer kind of forward towards the mid-wall point, that for sure in my room leads to a better response in this current room, which is going to change soon, which leads to a great response. Now, it is only for one seat.
Yeah, so I mean, it'd be interesting to go in there and make some measurements of different seats and see maybe you got lucky where you put that seat, or maybe it does. But where this sort of leads to, I think, is equalization, the bugaboo of, because I would say, okay, you could also put all your subs in one corner, and do some EQ to get also the response that you desire at your seat, and then that leads to the whole discussion of, I'm sure Ethan Weiner's probably turning over, gnashing his teeth right now, because he's very oriented towards acoustical solutions in that. And I've always thought that you can achieve the same thing with an equalizer, maybe not perfectly flat, but normally there's one or two modes that are causing an issue. And, if there's a boom or something, it's oftentimes at one frequency or maybe two, and that you with just some very, not too strenuous equalization, you can bring that down and you can approach it that way. But I know, that leads, I say, to a big discussion, which we could get into, but that's always been my thought anyway.
Are you a proponent of room acoustic treatments?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, sure. I think, I don't propose, going overboard. I don't think you need to spend a ton of money on, highly engineered and placed materials. And, I don't think you necessarily have to do that to get a good sound. I mean, if you want to and you want to play around with it and, by all means. But, I think I've always been sort of a minimalist that way, but put some absorption, just spread it around the room, if the early reflections always comes up. I mean, even Floyd Toole, who was my mentor and who's been all over the literature forwards and backwards, kind of threw up his hands and said, we'll just show it as optional. It depends on your taste and whatnot. But and if you're thinking of like bass traps and such, they can be, there's a use for that too, I guess. I mean, especially, well, here's another scenario. Let's say you don't know where your seats are going to be.
Right.
Because I'm assuming you know where your seats are going to be and they're fixed. But in some places, your audience is pulling up a chair, moving around. And in situations like that, maybe an acoustical treatment might be better, or these multiple subs might be better, and just, assume an area and say, I'm going to optimize for that area because I don't know where the seats are going to be. So that's another sort of distinction.
Do you believe that you can actually overdamp a room with acoustic treatments?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I've been in rooms like that.
Would you also agree? And I know that you're not specifically in speaker development, so I'm not going to bring up speaker development questions. However, I'm sure you know about waveguides in terms of what the benefit of them is and a properly designed loudspeaker. So would you also then say a properly designed loudspeaker is more important in terms of then the room? The room is important. However, a properly designed loudspeaker is more actually important than the room itself.
I would say it's most important. Yeah, okay, definitely. Most important. Yeah.
And if you incorporate the most important item of the room being the speaker and incorporate multiple subwoofers, four in this case, then you really do have an optimal system. Would you also agree?
I think so. And then in that case, you know, treatment of the room just becomes, you know, don't do anything way out of bounds. Good friend of mine, Anthony Grani, very smart guy, knows his acoustics forwards and backwards. And he, long time ago, told me about this 25% rule of thumb that he has, that, you know, roughly 25% of the room should have absorptive treatment on it. And if you've met that, then your room's not going to be horrible. I mean, you know, so, you know, that's moving in the other direction into very, very simple, you know, guidelines, but it's a good thing to have in the back of your mind.
And I believe that Floyd Toole also did some research in terms of reflections, how it can actually be beneficial, correct?
Reflections can be beneficial, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of the misunderstandings in, you know, moving up into mid and high frequencies, is that we have to control reflections. But that implies that reflections are bad, we have to control them.
Yeah. Right.
But in reality, you know, that's not necessarily true. I mean, it's good to be aware of them. You know, it's possible, you know, it's possible to have, you know, like a flutter echo would be an example of a type of reflection that does need to be controlled, you know. But, you know, in a room with absorption scattered around and a reasonably shaped room, you're not going to have too much trouble with that.
Do you need a lot of ceiling treatment typically?
That's another question that comes up a lot. I don't know. You know, going back to my consulting days, you know, we used to, when we had like lecture rooms and such, you know, we would always make sure and have a hard patch of ceiling, you know, roughly in between the seats and the front, and basically to, you know, make use of an extra reflection for intelligibility. So, I mean, there's one example of where those can be good. Or also communication in recording studios. A lot of times they'll put a hard patch of ceiling because, you know, going back to what you said about rooms with too much absorption, the room that I was thinking of when I said that, this was a recording studio that just had so much absorption in it that to communicate with somebody took noticeably more effort.
Interesting.
You know, especially if you're facing the other way and you're talking and the guy's like, what? I can't hear you. And you have to, there's more vocal effort is required. So, you know, but as far as like, you know, do you specifically where you put absorption on the ceiling, I don't know. I like to scatter it around. I'm not really a room. I haven't designed, you know, studios right. or anything. I've learned, you know, bits and pieces about acoustics and stuff, but I think people spend way more time debating that stuff than maybe it's worth. I don't know.
If somebody came up to you and said, Todd, I'm putting together a system, what do you recommend? And I'm not talking on the component level in terms, I'm talking to get optimum bass, optimal sound. What basics, what rule of thumb do you typically explain to them that are really important?
Yes, you want to get loudspeakers with good directivity control. And this also relates back to the absorption thing that, you know, as far as more or less absorption, if you're using loudspeakers that have directivity issues, then you might want to lean towards more absorption, because that's, you know, those flaws are going to be more audible in a room with more reflections in it, and vice versa. So the way you really want to go is you want to pick a loudspeaker that has good directivity control, and you probably want to go with a manufacturer who shows that, who gives you a plot that you can look at, and that weeds out already a lot of manufacturers, a lot of products. Not to say that they're bad or anything, but it, you know, if it were me, I would want to start with something that you know had been measured, and I knew that it had a reasonable. You don't want something that has a big dip in the directivity, or something like that.
And are you speaking towards polar plots specifically, not just an on-axis frequency response measurement?
Yes. So when I say directivity, I mean it could be a polar plots at multiple frequencies. You can see it there, or it may be a directivity plot. You know, which is basically the ratio of on-axis to sound power. Those sorts of things should be well controlled. I mean, you know, speakers are going to get more directive at high frequencies generally, and that is as it's supposed to be. But you don't want something that, you know, they use the wrong crossover between the direct radiator and a waveguide or horn or something. They have to, you know, it has to be crossed over where their directivities are roughly equal. So you you get a smoother activity, that sort of thing. And that, and you know, multiple subwoofers, you know, especially if you either have or anticipate more than one seat. And two is, you know, if you don't want to spend a lot of money, in my studies, I found that two was nearly as good as four. Quite, you know, interestingly enough.
Really interesting.
So yeah, two subwoofers is good. You know, I mean, a surround system is nice. I would probably steer somebody towards something like that if they could. Sound bars is one way to get, you know, convenient way to get that, but this results may vary for sure with those, because we're still learning how to, you know, create beams and get good effects with that. It's tricky. It's not easy. So, yeah.
Do you think that DSP has a place in a system?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I'm not, you know, an analog only kind of guy. I mean, I know those people, and they get upset if there's any, you know, everything's not analog, and you know, I more power to them if that, you know, whatever that they think. I've never really been convinced that that's the case, and you know, I think people spend in general way too much time worrying about and arguing about things that can, you know, either not be heard at all or only heard under the most controlled conditions. And even then, a lot of times, you know, you can do listening tests of, you know, digital versus analog, and maybe you could hear some slight difference. But the thing that most people forget, in my opinion, is whether it was preferred or not. Like when I was in school, I was told that if you set up a very sensitive three alternative force choice test under controlled conditions, people can hear almost anything. They can hear, they're very good at differentiating a very small sound. They'll glom onto any little thing that they can to tell the difference. But does that really mean that they preferred one or the other? That's the step that people seem to skip. They think that if they heard a difference, then okay, analog's better because, well, of course it's better and they heard a difference. But in reality, it may not have been preferred. If you tested preference, you might find it's 50-50 or whatever. So I think DSP has a lot of uses.
Are you okay with DSP across the whole frequency range, or would you just use it in down low, say 500 hertz and below?
I would use it for anything.
Okay.
You know, everything. I mean, there's so many, you know, algorithms, immersive audio algorithms and such that you know are only going to run in a digital system that you really, I don't think, you know, unless you're a die in the hard analog stereo guy or whatever, you know, then great. But as things move forward, I think DSP is going to become, it's going to be ubiquitous. I mean, there's just things you can't do without it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And moving on to, you first started out with subjective listening tests, right? And I would like for you to explain to the listeners how Harman conducts that, because that research, and I've seen papers about that, is it's intense, to say the least.
Yeah.
I would like for you to explain that to the listeners, because I think that's really important in a hobby that, whether it's cables, speakers, amplifiers, equipment, is so contentious. And it's really important, I think, for people to hear from the person that's been heavily involved in that research. So if you don't mind, Todd.
Absolutely. So I guess, you know, I mean, one way to look at it is we have biases, and or we call them nuisance variables. These are things that have an effect on the results you get, but don't really have anything to do with what you're interested in. And so the you know, one way to look at it is to identify all these nuisance variables and try to eliminate them. And you know, some of these are easier to eliminate than others. Like the biggest one that most people have probably heard of is, you know, double blind testing. So I guess, you know, visual biases. This has been documented for years and years, you know, that people and I have in my sort of standard presentation results that we did, where we tested people where they could see the branding on, you know, four speakers, and then when they couldn't see the branding, the results got very much more similar. And you know, so it's there's no doubt. I mean, that's one thing that's I will argue with anybody, you know, to the end of time. I mean, there's no doubt that that's one of the biggest biasing factors, and you have to eliminate that. So that means you have to figure out a way of doing your test in a blind fashion, and double blind is even better. So that means that the person who's running the test doesn't themselves know, you know, which one is which. That is nice, but you know, for sure the person taking the test should not be able to know what they're listening to. I mean, it seems obvious, but it seems to get forgotten a lot. Another one that we've worked hard on is positional bias. So like when we compare multiple speakers in a room, we have a device we call the shuffler. And what this does is that if we're testing four speakers, you know, at any time we're testing a speaker, it should be in the same place. So if we're testing speaker A, the shuffler moves speaker A into this position. And when I switch to speaker B, speaker A goes back and speaker B comes over into the same position. So there's, you know, the biggest reason for that is room modes, as like we were just discussing, is that when you move the speaker around, the response from it can change, you know, by 20 dB easily. So, you know, putting each device into the same location, you know, and that's probably on the other end of the spectrum of not easy to do versus easy right. to do. But you know, if you see somebody who's doing something like that in the research, then you know that they're, you know, you should pay attention because they know, yeah.
And I want to interject here just so people can understand the concept. When you say move the speaker, it is the shuffler itself is either robotically controlled or has some sort of moving turntable. Is that correct?
Yeah, ours is it has like a pallet that, you know, right. that move left and right forward. There's also circular ones that do accomplish the same thing. Yeah.
And it's laser controlled. So you know for sure that speaker is in that exact spot.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And this has all been modeled in software. So you know where not necessarily the ideal spot is for that speaker in that room. It's to make sure that all speakers are going in the same exact spot in that room.
Right.
Correct?
Okay. Yeah. So if you were going to pick a spot, it would be good to pick maybe not an ideal spot, but a typical spot or a not atypical spot would be good.
Right.
Because if you pick some cherry picked spot in the room, then maybe all the speakers are going to sound good or.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And you're able to model that.
Well, maybe not necessarily model, but by measurement, we can get that. So if we if we put a source in and we move it around and we, you know, we get a bunch of measurements and we pick one that's sort of typical and then we say, okay, that's a good spot.
And basically average all, in this case, say four loudspeakers, you're able to do that with all four and pick a spot that pretty much is equal for all four.
Yeah. The minimum bias. Yeah. Right. So, and the same goes for the seating position. We don't, you know, we can do the same thing with the seating position because that of course matters too. So, you know, there's other things, you know, listener training, that's another thing that it falls in that same category of expensive, you know, something that maybe not everybody can do, but, you know, we maintain a core of trained listeners and that's the only people we use for these tests. So we have training software, which I could send you another link to. We've developed some training software so people have a chance to practice and to hear things and to verbally put into words what they hear, which is useful. And, you know, not to mention audiometric testing. We test everybody first because, you know, if somebody is hearing impaired, I mean, not necessarily to say we would throw them out, but it would be good to know, you know, it would be good to know what the results are for normal hearing people. And then hearing impaired, actually, that's sort of a side subject, which is of interest as well, because, you know, I mean, there's the aging population that has generally some age-appropriate hearing loss. And what about those guys? And anyway, that's getting off subject there. But so generally, yeah, these biases and trying to control them And then, that's kind of the most succinct way I could put it.
Okay. And is the training of your listeners intense?
I don't know. I wouldn't say it's intense. It's kind of at your own pace, but we do have a requirement of a certain level of proficiency that they have to reach on the training software. So they have to get up to level 14, I think it is, or something. And you know, that takes some time. Some people there were one or two that never could quite get there. And there were other people that did it in a couple of days, but you know, we want to have some control over, you know, some people for whatever reason just can't, you know, I don't know, maybe it's a type of hearing loss that doesn't show up in an audiogram, but you know, we want to make sure that we have people that can hear those sorts of things. And And then experience too. I mean, when I started, I didn't have any experience, but I did it real intensively for like 5 years. And with all the practice, I got pretty good at it.
Interesting. So, now, is there a large group of people at Harman that have that?
Well, it used to be a lot larger. It's shrunk down over the years, but we still have some people that we can call on. Okay. I guess it's been something that's come up from time to time, as make a big push and get some more listeners. But actually, in Novi, we have a large contingent. I think, I don't know, maybe over 100 trained listeners there. So we can go over there and do tests, and they're pretty good.
That's a substantial amount of people.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
And headphone development, you've been involved in that, correct?
Correct.
What actually did you do?
Again, it was a lot to do with subjective. So, and measurement, just like the speakers, we did a lot of work on figuring out how to measure these, and a lot of, you know, we did subjective tests. And with the measurement side, I mean, there are standard devices that people use, you know, and we incorporate those into our work. The one area where we kind of maybe push the envelope a little bit is leakage. It's like room modes. It causes huge effects at low frequencies, and it's also not really been addressed, I don't think, as much as it should. So, you know, how to measure things and have the right amount of leakage, or how do we control leakage? We developed our own pinna that seemed to relate a little bit better to humans. So we test on humans, and then we test with these pinna. We tweak the pinna a little bit, and we try to get, you know, pinna that are more representative of how these things will actually fit on people.
Okay.
So that's, you know, then we gather a lot of measurements. And then on the other end, we do listening tests. And there's a method called method of adjustment that we use. What that means is, in essence, you give people some tone controls and you let them adjust it until they like it. I mean, it's really that simple. I mean,
interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there's some tricks and things that, you know, biases and nuisance variables again, but we control all those, and basically we give it to a lot of people, we let them adjust it, and we don't get too much into, you know, it's about the simplest sort of approach to subjective. It's just preference. How much do they like it? We want to have headphones that have responses that people like, and it's like the Wild West out there with headphones. When we've measured a lot, and they're all over the place. I mean,
yeah.
And people's opinions are all over the place. And we just wanted to come up with, you know, a starting point, a target curve. It sort of turned into a target curve. Now it's called the Harman target, and it's being used.
Called the Harman target.
It's the Harman target. It's being used by reviewers. There's manufacturers of test gear that are wanting to incorporate or already incorporating it into their test gear, so that you can put some headphones on and get this percentage preference score out of it. I think we might be going back to that. I think it's maybe there's some unfinished business there. If we get time and priorities, we might go back and work on that some more. So
when your listeners, when you gave them basically all the dials for EQ and let them be subjective to come up with what they like to hear, were those listeners trained listeners, or were they just the average person off the street, if you will?
Both.
Both.
We did some with trained listeners here and in Novi, and then we did other tests where we just got as many. We tried to get the trained listeners, but we would accept anybody. So we have results for trained and untrained, and there's some. Yeah, I could get into that too. There's differences, as you might expect.
Well, I would love to know what those differences are, and kind of if they were far apart or if they were somewhat similar in the end, or.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest difference is that the trained listeners are more consistent. We've seen this over and over again. So there's that. And then on average, you know, I think the untrained listeners maybe preferred a little bit more bass or something, you know, maybe a bit more bass and treble, sort of maybe that's the smiley curve thing coming in there. But the trained listeners tend to be maybe more oriented towards neutral. So there's that. But, you know, I think the biggest part of the difference is just consistency. And then way back, we did some study and we came out with, I think that the trained listener is worth approximately 7 untrained listeners or something like that. You know, as far as you need 7 times more untrained listeners to get the same statistical confidence. So
I have to say, Todd, and these are K371s, the AKG K371. I I don't know if you've had anything to do with these.
Those are intended to be hitting the target, and they come pretty close. So
they, I have to say, I listened to a lot of headphones when I was shopping for headphones for this purpose. Now, granted, it's only spoken word; it's not music. But of course, I listened with music, and I said to myself, I said, these are the closest thing to these for my ears.
Yeah.
And they're fantastic, and they're very inexpensive compared to so many of the other headphones that I listen to. I love them. I absolutely love them.
Well, I think, you know, hitting or getting, of course, there's always some element of personal preference, you know, which you can, you know, get a little EQ and whatever, and you can tune it to how you like, if you want, but starting with something that's pretty neutral and likely to be preferred is a good idea. And that, I think that gets you, you know, 75% of the way. And then on top of that, you know, people will talk about distortion and clarity, and there's other things, you know, but I think getting a reasonable starting, you know, target curve is the biggest part for me.
Do you think there's a lot more research to be done on headphones?
I do. Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, here's an example. Closed versus open. You know, people say, I've heard it over and over again, open headphones is more natural, spacious sound or whatever. And I always wondered to myself, is that just something that people manufacture because they think, oh, it's open, it should sound more natural or open. And, you know, but has anybody tested it? I don't know. I mean, I would love to do some to test to find out if it's true. And why is that? I mean, because you can tune either one of those headphones to have the same response at the eardrum. Then why should it sound any different? You know, that's a,
Have you done any tests with trained listeners?
Not for that specific, not really. I would love to. That's fairly far up on the list of things I would love to investigate.
Are you able to come up with the next, not the next job, but the next part of research that you want to take on? Are you able to have input in that?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it you know, there's business priorities and market, market studies, and they kind of know where we need to focus our efforts. And it's, you know, for me, it's all good. Whatever we work on is going to be interesting, I'm sure. But we also have some, you know, there's some trickle up, I guess, too, as to what, you know, we can propose things that would be interesting and useful and to work on. So
are you involved at all in the automotive side of Harman?
I was for about, you know, 3 or 4 years. We did some work doing binaural recordings in cars and working on a methodology for that. So we had a lot of interactions with those guys, and it continues in other ways, not as intense as it was then, but yeah, we have projects that we're doing with them. Again, you know, the general focus might be trying to, how to, you know, we've got a lot of good subjective data, and we've got all this objective data, you know, why don't we link this? We've already got the data. Why don't we try to link it together like we did for headphones and rooms? And pardon me. So that's like an example of an area that could be fruitful.
What part of the research really gets you most excited of all the research that you actively do and even in the past?
I like, you know, doing things that other people have maybe ignored or gone circumvented, you know, like this leakage thing is get me excited because I'm wondering, why am I the only one, you know, looking at this? Or, you know, so I love to, you know, address an area that's been underrepresented in the research and just really nail it in a way that could be, you know, published in a paper and peer reviewed. And I love to get comments from people who have read it and valid comments and, you know, why did you do this? And you did that wrong or whatever it is. I love, you know, thinking and debating about those things. So again, it all comes back to science and valid, you know, techniques and subjective. Anything to do with subjective is interesting because designing these tests is very challenging sometimes to simultaneously avoid all these different biases and come up with valid results is very challenging. So,
Ty, you bring up a great point about peer review. If you would, because some people might not be familiar with how that works and why it's so important. So if you can explain that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved in mostly the AES, Audio Engineering Society. So I'll, you know, shout out to them. Anybody who wants to get into the stuff in more detail, by all means, you don't necessarily have to join, but check it out. And there's all kinds of papers that have been published, and you know, they have a peer review process. So basically, they have, there's kind of like two levels there. Well, maybe more than two, but basically you have, you know, like a preprint, which is, you know, and then you have a journal paper. The journal paper will be much, you know, scrutinized at a much higher level. So anything, you know, whatever you see in there has been, you know, extensively peer reviewed. The preprints are reviewed at a lower level, just to reject anything that's just, you know, outlandish or ridiculous, whatever. So that's the that's how it works in the AES. You know, there's, you know, the Acoustical Society of America. They have their maybe similar processes, and there's other IEEE is more, maybe not so much acoustical, but they all have some kind of a peer review, and it's important. You know, if you read something that you know, from a forum or from some other, you know, a blog or something, it might be very interesting and true and revolutionary even or whatever, but just keep in mind, if it hasn't been peer reviewed, you can't just, you should never just accept anything. But it, you know, it's a little easier to give somebody the benefit of the doubt if it's been peer reviewed, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to share or that you feel is really important for listeners?
I guess I will maybe slightly reiterate on, you know, my, you know, after almost 30 years of in, you know, audio, I've come to the sort of position that, you know, worry about the important stuff first. You know, worry about, you brought up the loudspeaker. That's probably the single most important element of a good sound system. You know, if you have a crappy speaker, you know, you can put it in a great room. it's going to sound crappy, you know, and so on. But if you have a good speaker, from that point on, you'd almost have to try to really get horrible sound. I mean, you know, amplifiers, people spend so much time arguing about, you know, like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. And, you know, that's just my experience has been, you know, if it's fun and you like to debate it or whatever, and, you know, maybe, I'm not saying there's absolutely nothing there, but, you know, don't bypass the more important stuff and then spend your time debating stuff that's much less important. So learn about loudspeakers, how loudspeakers interact with rooms, directivity, those sorts of things. Get Floyd Toole's book, or, you know, there's other resources, you know, PowerPoint presentations, and just try to learn about how loudspeakers and rooms interact first before you maybe get off into the other stuff. That would be my advice.
Great message, Todd. I really do appreciate it. And I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. It's wonderful to finally meet you, and so informative. And again, I will link everything below for everybody to look at. Please like and subscribe. And if there's anything that anybody wants to know, they can certainly email me and I will forward it along to Todd, and we can wait for his wonderful response back. Just give him some time, because he is quite good.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Bring it on.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks for listening. Find us on YouTube and Facebook at the Intellectual People Podcast, and online at theintellectualpeoplepodcast.com. Check back for exciting new episodes.